Welcome to JFK Spotlight on Health. This is where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison. It's part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. I'm Joel Katz, and joining me this week is Dr. Zane Nakota, urologist with JFK Medical Center, special focus expertise in BPH treatment and surgical procedures. So that is what we're going to be talking about, and we'll also be talking about a new procedure a little bit later on in the program. We'll get to that, but first, let's say good morning to Dr. Nakota. Good morning.
Good morning, Joel. Thank you for having me on the air today.
Yeah, great to have you here. So let's start right up front. BPH, let's focus on that. It's an enlargement of the prostate gland, but tell us a little bit more about it.
Sure. So I would say this is probably one of the biggest problems that I see when patients come to the office, which is your prostate gets bigger, and as the prostate gets bigger, it tends to obstruct the urine flow from coming out. It can lead to various bothersome symptoms. So you may notice that the flow gets a bit weaker. There's a dribbling of urine at the end of the stream. It kind of starts and stops. It takes a little bit of while kind of standing there before it starts to come out. When you're in a bathroom stall, you may notice that the guy next to you, the stream comes out really quickly, and for you, you're sitting there for a while before it empties out. Those are some of the main symptoms that we see. And then we also get some irritative symptoms, like you're getting up multiple times at night to pee. You have to go very frequently. You get the urge to go. You got to stop and go right away, or you might have an accident. So those are the bothersome symptoms that occur. And the part that try to do is you try to find a way to get you to relieve some of those symptoms. But in the background, where that bladder is squeezing really, really hard against an obstruction from the prostate, that bladder can start to deteriorate. So we also focus on trying to find a way to maintain that bladder health.
So the number one sign is that having to urinate frequently.
You know what? Honestly, each person is a little bit different. Some patients, their main issue is getting up at night too many times. Some patients, it takes a lot longer to get out. And for some people, it is that urge to go very frequently. So each person can present in different ways. Mm-hmm. And it's not unique to one person to have just one symptom or the other.
Could you say that if someone who gets up how many times in the middle of the night, you would start to think, oh, this could be an issue?
What I would say is usually a change. So, like, you know, someone who's been getting up once or twice all their time, it might be related to because they drink a lot of water before bed or they're on certain blood pressure medications that make them go. But if you notice that it's becoming a bit more frequently, then typically a lot of times it could be due to BPH. So some patients getting up just once a night can be a major bother and it's a major change, and it could be a sign of their BPH symptoms. I have some patients who wake up 6, 7, 8 times a night to pee, and that can really make it difficult to get a good night's rest.
Can this lead to prostate cancer? Would a screening help if you get the signs of BPH, and then do you automatically recommend a prostate cancer screening?
So correct. So when anybody who comes into my office who has any sort of BPH treatment, we always get a rectal exam to see any hard nodules or spots in the prostate, along with a blood test called a PSA. Based on those findings, if they are both normal, we think the risk of prostate cancer is low, and we monitor that typically once a year. If any of those are elevated or abnormal, we'll often do some additional testing, such as getting an MRI of the prostate or proceeding with a biopsy of the prostate to check for cancer. Now, the thing about prostate cancer is that most type of prostate cancers are diagnosed in men with no symptoms at all, and they're just found from having an elevated PSA test. So many times I have patients who come in because that PSA test was checked by their primary care doctor. It's a little bit high, and we do a workup and diagnose cancer.
Okay.
And so usually the most recent guidelines recommend that you start screening at the age of 55 in an average male with no risk factors. But, you know, if you're 45 years old and you have certain risk factors, such as a family history of prostate cancer, or you're of African-American descent where you have a higher risk of getting prostate cancer in a more aggressive variety, we tend to check it sooner. And obviously, if you're having any sort of urinary symptoms, we usually check it sooner as well.
To be clear, you are diagnosing prostate cancer most times not from symptoms, just from a routine screening.
Correct. So the majority, what we recommend is getting an annual PSA test, mm-hmm. whether you're having symptoms or not. And there's been a bit of controversy over the many years between different organizations because many prostate cancers, most men will die with prostate cancer as opposed from prostate cancers. And our goal is to identify men who are at higher risk of having the more aggressive varieties, which will lead to problems in the future, and to treat those early. And while there's some controversy about it, and that's a bit of a difficult discussion to have, I think that's one that's worth a urologist or a primary care physician mm-hmm. about whether you feel that it's appropriate to do that screening and to go down the workup pathway.
Okay, so say I have symptoms of BPH and it's diagnosed. What is the treatment? First of all, treatment, very important, as soon as possible,
sure.
Correct?
So I guess on a global standpoint, BPH is an extremely, extremely common problem. In the United States, about 12 million men will go see a physician for management of BPH. That number of men who actually have BPH is probably much, much higher because they choose not to go see a doctor. Of those 12 million men, we usually will have a discussion about either watching and just watching and see if the symptoms get worse. We'll discuss starting medication treatment, or we'll discuss surgical option. So out of those 12 million men, on average, about 4 million men will choose to do nothing. About 6 to 7 million men will choose to try medications, of which about 1 to 2 million, the medications will fail or will not be effective. And about 400,000 men will choose a surgical procedure.
So it's either do nothing, take medicine, or have surgery. Of the men who choose to do nothing, they're just dealing with it? Is there any danger
there? The main thing we care about is symptom relief. So it depends on how bothered you are by the symptoms. That's kind of the main driver about whether we choose to do a treatment. And however, the other part that I always keep a close eye on is also that bladder health component. So the bladder is a muscle. It's a pump. And its job is to squeeze and push the urine out, just like the heart pumps the blood through our body.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we do a lot of things to make sure our heart is healthy. We make sure we eat healthy. We make sure our blood pressure is controlled, things that we don't necessarily feel. So I always do that same analogy that it's important to make sure that we make sure healthy as well, because if the bladder fails, there's no way to reverse that. There's no way to fix that medically or surgically. And the best way to help relieve the deterioration of the bladder is to reduce how to squeeze or work to get the urine out. And by using medications or procedures, we can relieve that obstruction, and the bladder doesn't have to work as hard. And as you get older, you help maintain a healthier bladder.
So there's no bladder replacement?
Yeah, correct. So as of now, obviously, there are studies and treatment research being done to develop new bladders and implant new bladders. But typically, those are going to be used, I think, more for patients who have bladder cancer and the bladders are removed, or they have from a neurogenic condition that bladders don't work at all. But that is, far away in the future and will be pretty major surgery to do any sort of bladder replacements.
Mm-hmm.
But now there's really, once the bladder fails, it fails. And in those rare cases, I have patients who have to live with a catheter draining into a bag all the time, or learn how to put a catheter in about 3 to 4 times a day to get the urine out.
We're talking with Dr. Zane Nakota at JFK Medical Center, expertise in BPH treatment and surgical procedures. But then there's medications. And how often do the medications work, and what are some of the types of medications that you recommend?
There are basically, I would say, there's 3 main categories of BPH medications that we use. One of them are alpha blockers, and what they do is they help relax the smooth muscle within the prostate to allow the urine to come out more easily. It's typically the one that we typically start with. They can be relatively effective in many men, but unfortunately, they do carry some side effects that not everybody is so happy.
So you just have to try different medications to see which ones that you have side effects and which ones you don't.
Correct. So usually when you first come in, we'll talk about that there's basically 3 categories of BPH medications that we use.
Okay.
The first one, that's the most common one, is an alpha blocker. A common one that you may have heard of is called Flomax, and it relaxes the smooth muscle of the prostate to help the urine come out more easily. However, it can lead to dilation. It can lead to some dizziness and nasal congestion, which can be quite bothersome. And it can also lead to a condition called a floppy iris syndrome, which can affect if you ever get cataract surgery in the future. The second one is a medication that's going to shrink the prostate down. It blocks something called dihydrotestosterone. And the downside of that medication is that it can take several months to years to actually shrink the prostate down, and it can lead to some loss of libido and sexual dysfunction. The third main class of medications is a medication you may have heard called Cialis or Tadalafil. Typically, you people hear it is used for erectile dysfunction, but a daily dose can also help with urinary flow. So we'll basically, discuss at the first visit about how bothersome the symptoms are. We typically use a questionnaire to figure out which symptoms are the more bothersome to you or not, what degree of severity it is, and then we'll decide to try one or multiple of these medications and see how you react to it and whether it helps or not.
Yeah, that was my next question about what is the process when someone comes to see you, and how does that How do they end up getting to you? But you say they come in and they fill out a questionnaire and you have some questions for them, right?
Exactly. So there's patients typically come for one or two reasons. Either they're having symptoms and they come in on their own looking to get help, or they've talked to their primary care doctor who has referred them to see me. We'll often always do a, as we mentioned earlier, a prostate cancer screening with a rectal exam that gives me an idea whether there's any concern for cancer, but also approximately how large your prostate is. I always like to do a questionnaire, and it's good for me to get a baseline of what your symptoms are at this time. And then we do a repeat questionnaire after we do any type of treatment to see if there's been an objective improvement in those symptoms that you're having. And then we'll discuss at that time about first trying medications. And if someone is telling me, you know what, I really don't want medications, I'd rather get a more permanent relief for this, we'll talk about a workup on how we can decide if you're a good candidate for a surgical procedure. And there's basically two tests that we do in addition to the cancer screening to decide that. One is called a cystoscopy. That's where we put a thin, flexible camera through the urethra and the penis into your bladder. We take a look at the prostate, the size of it, the shape of it. We take a look at the entire bladder, and we look to see if you've developed any bladder changes from the obstruction. And that whole thing takes only about a minute. It can be done in the office with local anesthetic. It can also be done under some sedation if you have anxiety about having it done awake. And then the second part is an ultrasound to measure the size of the prostate, because the size of the prostate will help us determine which procedures you're a candidate for and which procedures you are not.
Is there ever a patient who wants to have a procedure as opposed to medication because they don't want to take the medication or the side effects, whatever the reason, but you don't recommend that?
You know, the only time I would say that surgery is not a good option for you is if I do not feel that you can tolerate the risks of the procedure. But I think that there's really no situation where if a patient tells me that, hey, I do not want to be on a medication long term, that I would say, oh, don't get the surgery. You have to try the meds first.
Okay.
Now, sometimes we are limited by insurance reasons where in order to get covered for a procedure, you have to do a trial of medications first. So sometimes we have to go down that pathway for that reason.
Okay.
But from a medical standpoint, I don't think there's a reason why you have to try medications or be forced to take medications if you don't feel comfortable taking those.
Talking with Dr. Zane Nakota, JFK Medical Center, special focus and expertise in BPH treatment and surgical procedures. That's what we're talking about. Let's get into the surgical procedures. We talked about those who decide they want to do nothing about BPH. Then there's the medications. And then there's some several different kinds of procedures. There's minimally invasive ones, and then there's the more invasive procedures. Let's discuss first the surgical options that are minimally invasive.
Sure. So as you mentioned, when you've decided to a point that we want to go under surgery, it's typically because you cannot, the meds are not working, you can't tolerate the side effects, or you choose not to be on medications forever. We'll do the cystoscopy and the prostate exam. We'll do the prostate cancer screening. And then we'll determine that, okay, you're a candidate for one procedure or not. Now, the more minimally invasive procedures are what we call the non-resective procedures. And there are basically two main ones that I offer. The first one is a steam treatment. It is done in the office. It's done under local anesthetic. And we put a camera inside, and we put a needle into the prostate, and we instill steam or water vapor that will, over a period of 6 weeks, dissolve the tissue away and create a channel for the urine to flow through. The entire procedure is typically done in less than 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
And it takes about 6 weeks to sort of for the procedure to work, for that channel to be created. The second procedure is called a prostatic urethral lift. The most common one is called a UroLift procedure. That can be done either in the office under local or under some light sedation in the hospital. That one in itself is typically about a 10 to 15 minute long procedure. So again, not a long procedure, also done with no incisions with a camera, where a little clips are placed in the prostate to basically lift the tissue away and create a channel for the urine to flow through. It is the only procedure that allows you to maintain the ejaculation 100%, and many times you can go home without a catheter. So both of those, I think, are really well at helping men get off medications. They create a significant symptom relief. They help decrease that bladder pressure. The downsides of those procedures, however, are their durabilities. Typically, on average, those procedures are good for about 5 years, maybe up to 10 years. But at that time, you'll probably need another procedure later on in life as that prostate grows and starts to obstruct again.
I see. So the problem's going to come back. It depends how long. You said 5 to 10 years.
Correct. And then there are some limitations, too. So
okay.
If your prostate is too large, then you're not really a candidate for these minimally invasive office procedures because they will just not be effective enough. So if the prostate is too big or the shape of the prostate is such that there's a large lobe that's growing inside the bladder, then it may not be worth going through a procedure that's going to be unlikely to be efficacious for you. So it is definitely something that is personalized based on what those workup and diagnostic workups show.
Now, do the more invasive procedures, will they last longer?
Correct. So the more invasive procedures tend to be more durable, but they tend to carry they require typically general anesthesia. They typically require an overnight stay in the hospital, and there are more side effects associated with it. So the most common two procedures that you'll probably hear about is either a green light laser prostatectomy or a TURP procedure, which stands for a transurethral resection of the prostate. So here is where we go in and we either use a laser or we use a loop to cut out the inner core of the prostate. It creates a really nice channel, but as a result of it, typically you will lose your ejaculation going forward. So you'll still have maintained erections, you'll still maintain orgasms, you'll just have a dry ejaculation. And so that is something that, again, you need to determine whether how important that is for you when you decide which treatment option you go through. One of the nice things about the first two options you mentioned, the minimally invasive ones, such as the steam treatment or the lifts, is that let's say you fail that procedure, you do not prevent yourself from moving on to the more invasive procedures down the road.
Okay. Right. So, yeah, it's not like if you try one thing and it doesn't work, you're done.
You're not done, right? So
if
let's say you try the lift and you don't like and after a couple of years it's not effective anymore, we can always move on to doing additional lifts or move on to doing that TURP procedure or the laser prostatectomy and move on to a more invasive one. So you never burn any bridges by doing one or the other.
Best case scenario, you're good forever?
Best case scenario, you might be good forever. But again, maybe 10, 20 years down the road, you may need something else done.
Okay.
A lot of it comes down to how large your prostate is to start with, how much tissue we're able to remove, and each person is different about how quickly that prostate adenoma starts to grow back.
Talking with Dr. Zane Nakota, JFK University Medical Center. For the last 5 minutes we have left, about 5 minutes, I want to focus on what is a new procedure, aquablation. Could you tell us about that? Let's get into that.
This is something that we're super excited about. JFK Medical Center is the only hospital in Central Jersey that has it at this time. And it's basically revolutionized BPH surgery, I would say, because it has it minimizes the side effects of BPH surgery by minimizing the risk of loss of ejaculation, helps you maintain continence much better than the TURP or the green light prostatectomy could, while still getting you a very nice, durable opening that's going to be good for many years. The other nice thing about this is that size does not matter. Whether you have a small prostate, a large prostate, this procedure works for basically all sizes and shapes. And so there's very few cases where you're unable to do it. And the way that it essentially works is that we use two modes to identify the prostate. We put an ultrasound. And this is, again, all done while you're asleep under anesthesia. We put an ultrasound probe in the rectum, and we can visualize the prostate and all the different markers, such as the bladder neck and the ejaculatory ducts, under ultrasound. We also will put a cystoscope, which is that camera that goes into the urethra, into the bladder, to visualize where the bladder prostate lobes are, where the bladder neck is, where the bladder begins, and the prostate, where the prostate begins, where the bladder ends. And then we will spend about 20 minutes doing all of the measurements. So each person will have a different type of prostate shape and size. And we'll use the ultrasound and the cystoscope to mark out which parts of the prostate we want to resect and which parts of the prostate we want to preserve. And the areas you want to preserve are important to help maintain ejaculation and help maintain your continence. And then once all the mapping is done, the actual ablation part, which is used a strong water jet to remove the tissue without using any heat or energy, only typically takes anywhere between 4 to 8 minutes. And what that does is creates a really, really nice channel in the prostate where you have the obstructing tissue while maintaining the other important areas to maintain sexual function.
Mm-hmm.
And when we're doing the mapping, we'll decide how aggressive you want to be about these resections. If you tell me, you know what, I really want you to focus on the opening and I don't really care about my ejaculation, we'll be more aggressive. If you tell me I really, really want to make sure I maintain my ejaculation, we'll be much less aggressive in those areas. After the procedure is done, we put a camera back in, and we make sure that if there's any spots that are bleeding a little bit more excessively than we would like, we will cauterize those spots. There's a catheter left in overnight, and the next morning, if everything goes well, the catheter comes out, and you go home without a catheter the next day.
And that's it.
And that's it. And the rates, you know, are about 90% of men are able to maintain their ejaculation after the procedure. Because we minimize the use of heat or energy, there's less irritative symptoms. And the opening is pretty incredible that you get in there. And I would say they're just as good as getting a TURP procedure done. And the other really nice thing is that really large glands, sometimes it's very difficult to get a very big channel with a TURP procedure. And if you have a very, very large gland, you can get a very nice, durable opening in a one-time procedure that will get you on the table for much less anesthesia time.
What's the percentage of men who are eligible for this?
So basically, for now, it is a newer procedure. And so there are sometimes, honestly, there's more limitations on what the insurances will allow or not. So let's say you have a diagnosis of a prostate cancer. You may not be covered to have this procedure done. But I would say for the vast majority of men, because it allows you to treat pretty much every sizes, I would say probably 80% of men would be eligible for this procedure if they choose to proceed.
Aquablation is what it's called. And this is a new procedure that seems to be better than all the others.
Yes, it's definitely revolutionized the way that we treat it. And again, I would say in terms of the slightly more invasive procedures, it is definitely replacing how we are dealing with BPH and helping to maintain that sexual function at the same time.
Awesome. Dr. Zane Nakota, JFK University Medical Center, thank you so much for being on the program.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
For more info, go to jfkmc.org. And for a podcast of this show, you can go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health, brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz. We'll talk to you next week.